From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. On today's program, President Obama's speech on the future of U.S. surveillance operations at home and overseas.
Now, the reforms I'm proposing today should give the American people greater confidence that their rights are being protected.
We'll ask whether the balance he struck between civil libertarians and the national security establishment amounts to meaningful change. Also today, a brutal execution in Ohio on Thursday. Will it change the death penalty debate in America?
Everybody who witnessed what happened yesterday was traumatized, which would include, the people from the state who were actually carrying out the execution.
And higher than anyone imagined, marijuana sales in Colorado. That's coming up on FSN Reports after our summary of the day's main stories.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. President Obama has called for limits to be placed on the National Security Agency's controversial practice of storing data on vast numbers of U.S. telephone calls. The president also directed America's intelligence agencies to stop spying on friendly international leaders. He also called for extending some privacy protections to foreign citizens whose communications are scooped up by the U.S. Obama's announcement capped the review that followed former National Security Agency analyst Edward Snowden's leaks about secret surveillance programs. The president tried to strike a balance between national security needs and civil liberties.
The basic values of most Americans when it comes to questions of surveillance and privacy converge a lot more than the crude characterizations that have emerged over the last several months. Those who are troubled by our existing programs are not interested in repeating the tragedy of 9/11. And those who defend these programs are not dismissive of civil liberties. The challenge is getting the details right, and that is not simple.
A set of U.S. and Russian peace proposals appear to be gaining traction with the Syrian government after Damascus announced an offer for a prisoner swap. But the fractured set of rebel groups have yet to respond. From Washington, Daniel Wrenches reports.
The proposals from the Syrian government to exchange prisoners with rebels and for a ceasefire in the city of Aleppo come in advance of peace talks scheduled for next week in the Swiss city of Montreux. The announcement may represent a significant step towards a possible deal promoted by U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov, with the two also calling for increased access for humanitarian aid, which the Syrian government now says it's willing to do. But it's unclear whether the US-backed Syrian National Coalition is willing to engage with the new proposals or even attend the talks at all.
Chaos has broken out in Ukraine's parliament, with fights and attempts to block the speaker's platform breaking out between MPs. The president's politicians rushed through sweeping anti-protest laws with votes by a quick show of hands, a move which the opposition denounced as an illegal coup d'etat. The hurried laws amid the country's political crises are raising fears of police storming of a central Kiev square, occupied by anti-government protesters for over 2 months. Tom Barton reports.
The new legislation includes bans on unauthorized tents, stages, or amplifiers in public places, precisely what protesters have set up on the now famous Maidan Square. Heavy fines or detention are the punishment. Protests involving vehicles, which have been used outside government offices in recent days, have also been banned. And another could force a person to do corrective labor for a year if they slander government officials. But the three main opposition leaders say the vote of raised hands is illegitimate, and the new laws will only provoke Ukrainians.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni has blocked a controversial anti-homosexuality bill. Museveni says there should be the option to reform homosexuals instead of imprisoning them. The bill, which was passed in December by Uganda's parliament, would see those found guilty of homosexual acts jailed for life. Michael Baleke reports from Kampala.
President Museveni said the anti-homosexuality bill was passed through parliament in a rush. The Ugandan president argues that under the law, homosexuals should not be killed or persecuted. The homosexuality bill sailed through the Ugandan parliament last December, but only after lawmakers agreed to drop the death penalty clause. Uganda also received large amounts of criticism from some Western nations, with donors threatening to withdraw funding to the country. Despite blocking the bill, President Museveni warned that homosexuality should not be promoted in Uganda. Museveni's revelations come days after the Nigerian president, Goodluck Jonathan, passed a similar bill criminalizing homosexuality into law.
And U.S. housing starts fell 9.8% in December, slightly less than most observers expected. Despite the decline, 2013 was the best year for the industry since 2007. Iris Spitzer has more from New York.
On new U.S. homes fell 9.8% to a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 999,000, according to the U.S. Commerce Department. Economists, however, had expected the unusually cold weather to slow the pace of building, and the drop was less than expected. Still, there is a general sense of optimism in the housing market. 2013's overall numbers were up 18% compared to last year and the highest in the past 6 years. Permits for future projects declined, however, a sign that building activity may slow down in early 2014. Mortgage rates are expected to continue to rise this year, which could put more pressure on the housing market.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports. The news today is dominated by President Obama's speech at the U.S. Justice Department this morning, outlining the approach he plans to take on the activities of the National Security Agency and the electronic surveillance the U.S. government undertakes here at home and overseas. It was a far-reaching speech, literally beginning with a reference to Paul Revere, but telling the country that the intelligence community is now at a crossroads, technologically able to do almost anything, and, as the president put it, more effective than other intelligence services elsewhere. It was a speech in which he walked a tightrope between the outrage of civil libertarians and the anxiety of the intelligence establishment. Charting that walk for us, FSN's Alice Alstein.
Currently, the National Security Agency can collect the phone records of nearly every U.S. citizen, store that data for years, and comb through it when it decides internally that a certain number is suspicious. They can then investigate not only everyone the suspect calls, but everyone all of those people call and everyone those people call, a so-called three-hop procedure that potentially sweeps up the records of thousands of people. In one of the biggest reforms he unveiled this morning, President Obama said all of that will soon change.
Effective immediately, we will only pursue phone calls that are two steps removed from a number associated with a terrorist organization, instead of the current three. And I have directed the Attorney General to work with the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court so that during this transition period, the database can be queried only after a judicial finding, or in the case of a true emergency.
The president also said he will explore ways to take this data out of the government's hands by the time the program is up for renewal in March. But he said outright that he will not end the program, and he seemed wary of embracing a White House panel recommendation that private corporations hold the information instead.
Any third party maintaining a single consolidated database would be carrying out what's essentially a government function, but with more expense, more legal ambiguity, potentially less accountability, all of which would have a doubtful impact on increasing public confidence that their privacy is being protected.
NSA has got to go! Hey, Obama, don't you know? The NSA has got to go!
As the president outlined these steps to restore public confidence in the NSA, a group of civil liberties activists gathered outside to protest, saying the proposed reforms do not go far enough.
It's still unlawful and unconstitutional to suck up people's information indiscriminately and just say, okay, we're going to house it here, but not look at it.
That's Adwoa Masozi with the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, who said she and other advocates across the country plan to continue protesting until Congress or the president implement more sweeping reforms.
It's really going to take a united global front of the people to challenge the consolidation of the corporate and government power.
Following the speech, many civil liberties advocates, including former NSA analyst Russ Tice, took issue with the president's assertion that there has been no indication the spy agencies have intentionally abused their authorities.
NSA has committed crimes. Here's the things that I witnessed between 2002 and 2005. Is I saw that NSA was spying on Congress, they were spying on the Supreme Court, they were spying on journalists and news agencies and reporters. These were targeted spying, where they would go after their phone conversations and their computer communications, word for word, Don't tell me that there's been no abuses.
Another former NSA analyst, Kirk Wiebe, noted that the abuses continue to this day. He referenced a leaked document published this week by The Guardian showing the NSA has been secretly collecting an estimated 200 million text messages from individuals around the world.
They have a vacuum cleaner for texting. They're sucking up every text message you put out.
Wiebe also noted a troubling detail in the president's speech. He said the NSA will only need to prove reasonable suspicion of someone's connection to terrorism in order to search through their private data. This is a lower legal standard than probable cause, the threshold in the Bill of Rights for government searches and seizures.
Without probable cause, no one has the right to go through your personal effects, papers, things, stuff. They have no right. And the president reiterated reasonable suspicion that flies in the face of our national history. We're moving the dot on the Constitution.
In the spirit of transparency, the president made public the formal legal document implementing the reforms he described. The president's document echoed his speech, saying he's dedicated to protecting privacy and protecting citizens from harm.
The challenge is getting the details right, and that is not simple.
Now it will be up to Congress, the courts, and the general public to hold the president to his word and weigh in on how to properly strike that balance. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Now, the president's speech was being closely watched not just in the United States, but also outside it. Relations with a number of overseas nations have been frayed as a result of Edward Snowden's revelations, and the president's personal relationship with leaders like German Chancellor Angela Merkel and Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff have suffered enormously. I asked FSN's Director of European News Coverage, Ollie Barrett, how the speech had gone down on the other side of the Atlantic.
Well, I think in different parts of Europe it will go down in different ways. For example, in Germany, there has been real public anger about the alleged tapping of Angela Merkel, the Chancellor's, phone calls. And they, I think, the German people and the German political establishment would have wanted to hear rather more from President Obama in the sense that he would have been cracking down on some of these practices. Here in the UK, there seems to have been a bit more of a muted response from the public. When President Obama says he wants the American allies to feel like they're being treated like real partners, that, as I say, will not make people feel mollified in Germany, where, you know, they were pushing for things like a no-spy agreement between the two countries. That was not forthcoming from President Obama, and as a result, German anger may well continue for some time.
Well, indeed, there is a contradiction here, because that no-spy agreement appears to have run into trouble, the Germans say, because of President Obama's and the White House's refusal to say there will be no more direct operations conducted against foreign leaders like German Chancellor Angela Merkel. And yet in this speech he says, quote, "I have made clear to the intelligence community that unless there is a compelling national I have made clear to the intelligence community that unless there is a compelling national security purpose, we will not monitor the communications of heads of state and government of our close friends and allies." Is that not enough for the Germans?
I suspect not. You know, world leaders, President Obama is not the only one who will say things about their intelligence agencies and then later down the line be found out to have slightly been not quite and will later have been found out down the line to have stretched the truth. Let's put it that way. The Germans wanted more than that. They don't want words in a speech. They wanted an agreement. They wanted the U.S. to sign a piece of paper. So, no, that won't make those in Germany who are angry satisfied. It won't be enough.
And I'm guessing that Germans and other people in Europe will not warm to the more pugnacious language in this speech, where he says not only will the intelligence agencies continue to gather information about the intentions of governments around the world, but we will not apologize simply because our services may be more effective than theirs.
No, and that's the kind of line that in the UK I think people will look at and have some sympathy for. In the UK, people look upon spies and feel that the British spying establishment is one of the best in the world. For example, in Brussels, there's been real anger among European politicians, members of the European Parliament and people of the European Commission about these various spying allegations relating to European allies. And I suspect that sentence will not have gone down very well at all in Brussels and among European parliamentarians who don't have the same well-established spying practices and history like the United States. That certainly will not have been what the European Commission, for example, wanted to hear. Although, as I say, here in the UK, perhaps a little bit more sympathy with an idea like that.
Ollie Barrett, FSN's Director of European News Coverage, on the line today from London. Thanks very much. This is FSN Reports. When the history of death row in America is finally written, it seems certain that Thursday's execution of inmate Dennis McGuire in Ohio will occupy more than a footnote. It took Mr. McGuire more than 10 minutes to die after a new, previously unused combination of lethal drugs was administered to him in the death house in Lucasville. Mr. McGuire was convicted of the 1989 murder of Joy Stewart. She was 8 months pregnant at the time of her murder. Earlier this week, prosecutors in the case told a judge that Mr. McGuire was not entitled to a pain-free execution. Alan Bonnet was his public defender, and he told me that with hindsight, that assertion by prosecutors came to a chilling reality on Thursday.
Yeah, I think that's fair based on the information that we have at this point. Our argument all along was that Mr. McGuire would, in fact, suffer significant agony and terror. And from the reports that we have thus far, that seems to be exactly the case of what happened.
The reports that came from the death chamber itself, it, not only did it appear to take quite a while for your client to die, but initially there also seemed to be confusion about just how long the process had taken. There were conflicting reports immediately after the execution about precisely what had happened.
Indeed, there seemed to be. I've seen some reports that said 15 minutes and others that said 25 minutes, and I'm not exactly sure what the basis for that confusion was. As you can imagine, there can be quite a bit of confusion in that context, and people wanting to be kind of first out of the gate with whatever the reports were on what was sure to be a significant media event. So I don't honestly know. I was not actually in the death house, witnessing the execution in person. Although I was down there, I was not actually in the death house itself.
Now, members of his family were in the death house, and whatever one's view is of the use of the death penalty and its application, and whatever trauma he may have faced as he was put to death, certainly for members of his family, this was also extremely traumatic.
That would be kind of, I think, a certainly more than reasonable assessment. As you can imagine, it was a fairly emotional situation after they returned back to the waiting area where we were, we being myself and some other attorneys. Certainly from what we saw, they were traumatized, and I think that there should also be no question that everybody who witnessed what happened yesterday was traumatized, which would include, the people from the state who were actually carrying out the execution and that kind of thing. I certainly don't want to forget them as well in all of this, that the trauma that was undeniably occurring yesterday was not only inflicted on Mr. McGuire and those who were witnessing on his behalf, but indeed on everybody who was there seeing firsthand what was unfolding in the death chamber.
You had warned that this execution could be extremely difficult because of the cocktail of chemicals that was being used. Can you just reprise for us what was the nature of the warning that you issued when you were trying to appeal this case in its final hours?
Well, the nature of the warning was essentially that there is ongoing federal civil rights litigation in federal court here in Ohio over the way that Ohio has carried out executions and does carry out executions, and the nature of the specific allegations that were raised in the emergency litigation on behalf of Mr. McGuire specifically were that the method of execution that Ohio planned to use, the 10 grams of midazolam and 40 grams of hydromorphone, was going to essentially cause him to suffocate to death while he was aware of suffocating to death for a certain period of time. The state assured everybody and the judge that no, based on their expert who insisted no, that wouldn't be an issue because there would be no problems whatsoever, that Mr. McGuire would not experience anything beyond the first 30 seconds to a minute or so, and that he would be dead or at least unaware of anything right around that time, not more than a minute or so. Sadly, at this point I would submit that there's an argument to be made that would be certainly compelling that there is evidence now of the danger and the risk involved in using this experimental method that Ohio used.
Assistant Federal Public Defender Alan Bonnet talking to us from Columbus, Ohio. Now to the intersection of technology and child abuse in the developing world, and a new warning from British police about an emerging threat to children in developing nations. It comes after investigators smashed a paedophile ring that was live streaming the abuse of children in the Philippines over the internet to audiences in the UK and other countries. 15 children aged between 6 and 15 were rescued after officers identified where in the Philippines the abuse was taking place and several people were arrested. From FSN's London Bureau, Natalie Powell reports.
Operation Endeavour spanned 14 countries and was led by the UK's National Crime Agency. 5 of the 17 suspects in the UK have already been convicted. It's understood 2 of the suspects have died and 1 has been released without charge, while 9 are still being investigated. The multinational inquiry began when police searched the house of a registered sex offender, Timothy Ford, who lives in Northampton, England. Material found on his computer led to a lengthy and complex investigation. And as the National Crime Agency's operations manager, Stephanie McCourt, explains, it's the sort of operation the NCA expect to see more of in the future.
Because of the internet, we're transcending international borders all of the time. We have to cooperate. So Operation Endeavour is an example of that. Probably not groundbreaking, but certainly with live streaming and lots of internet-based cybercrime type operations, we're going to be seeing that more and more as we move towards the future. So paving that ground is so important because together we're so much stronger.
Outside of the UK, 29 arrests have been made. Suspects have been identified in countries including Australia, the US, France, Germany, Canada, Scandinavian countries, Hong Kong, and Taiwan. Worldwide investigations are also underway into men who pay to view online abuse. So far, 733 suspects have been identified. 139 of them are British. Campaigners like Bharti Patel from End Child Prostitution and Trafficking UK say this is a sad development in child sex tourism.
What we're seeing now is a new form of child sex tourism. This is a webcam-based child sex tourism. And now the perpetrator no longer needs to pay to travel to another country. He or she, mainly it's a he, can do this down the line. He just needs to have a computer and internet access. And at the other end, somebody to facilitate his interaction with a child.
And Philippine authorities say they believe between 60 and 100,000 children could be caught up in sex abuse, while Britain's NCA has described the online virtual abuse as an emerging threat, particularly to developing countries.
Although we're focused on the Philippines as a result of Operation Endeavour, it's quite clear to us that when you're looking at the elements of the crime that make up this sort of investigation, and those are, of course, the poverty, the high-speed internet, and in relation to the infrastructure that you can find most of the time in developing countries, this creates the perfect setting for this sort of criminality. So although, yes, the Philippines is an issue, we're very aware that this could be played out in other locations around the world as well.
Britain's National Crime Agency believes this latest investigation makes it clear that men who take part in abuse via internet connections thousands of miles away are just as guilty as if they carried out the abuse themselves. They say protecting children from this danger and dismantling organised criminal groups is a top priority. Natalie Powell, London.
Finally tonight, 2 weeks after the sale of marijuana for recreational purposes began in the state of Colorado, sales are through the roof. The nation's first recreational pot stores opened there on New Year's Day, and a leading manufacturer of marijuana says that vendors are now rationing the sale of cannabis-laced cookies and candies so their supply doesn't run out. FSN's Denver correspondent Mary McCarthy is following the story for us, and Daniel Wrench has asked her if the recreational marijuana market is even bigger than projected.
That's exactly right. Dixie Edibles and Elixirs in Denver is one of the main suppliers of marijuana products you can eat or drink. They're saying demand is so high that most pot shops are limiting customers to just one or two edibles per day. Dixie, like many of Colorado's marijuana businesses, is currently expanding its production capacity so they can continue to meet demand over the coming months.
Legally, Mary, there are still some grey areas to be worked out, aren't there? For example, it's still illegal to use marijuana in public, so where are tourists supposed to smoke?
Well, for Colorado residents, it's easy. You can just use the drug in the privacy of your own home. The Denver City Council even voted to allow residents to smoke on their front porches in full public view. But for tourists, it's a lot more complicated. Many hotels ban smoking and have specific regulations banning the use of cannabis. Of course, entrepreneurs are already starting to cash in on this with marijuana-friendly bed and breakfasts, for example, suddenly popping up.
In Colorado, it's now as easy to purchase pot as it is to buy a six-pack of beer. So what are the public health concerns about the easy access to cannabis now?
Well, one of the top concerns is making sure that people realize how strong the marijuana is here in Colorado. Much of what's being sold here was developed for use in the medical marijuana industry, so it's extremely potent and should be consumed in small amounts, according to all the professionals who are selling it and to the public health officials. There's also our calls for a major public health campaign warning that the drug poses risks to teenagers when it comes to brain development and that it can be very harmful to children, especially in those tempting but very strong edible forms.
FSN's Mary McCarthy on the line from our bureau in Denver. And that's the Friday edition of FSN Reports. A reminder that we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. And you can follow our news coverage 24 hours a day on Twitter. We are there at Feature Story. On Monday, Martin Luther King Day, an extended conversation about one of the biggest issues facing the US today, cybersecurity. We talk to Pete Singer. His new book, co-authored with his Brookings Institution colleague Alan Friedman, is called Cybersecurity and Cyber War: What Everyone Needs to Know.
As long as we're using the internet, we will have cybersecurity and cyber war issues to deal with. And so what we need to do is change our mentality towards it, understand the issues, and then we can better manage them.
That's Pete Singer on Monday's edition of FSN Reports. But for now, I'm Simon Marks alongside Rebecca Foster at the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great weekend. Goodbye.